Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KABU's Political Perspectives. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin. Joining me in the studio is Ronald Latang-Sayang Catalani. He's the senior contributing editor for The Asian Reporter. He's also known as Polo. He's an immigrant rights activist and an attorney. For the city of Portland, he's the Immigrant and Refugee Affairs Coordinator. He's also the author of an evocative new book, Counterculture: Immigrant Stories from Portland Cafe Counters. So thanks for joining us today, Polo.
Oh, thank you for asking, Linda.
I'm so glad to have you. Right off, I want to start out saying that your book was beautiful. It's a thin volume or a slender volume, but very rich in details, the kind of details that drew me right in and had me smelling what you were smelling and feeling the emotions you were feeling. So I want to thank you for it and let you know that I'm not going to do your book justice in the sense that I think someone should be interviewing you about how it was you wrote it and the writing itself and the beauty that's there. But I'm going to take you to the politics that are sort of permeated through it.
That's a good idea. Thank you for your kindness, and I'll do the best to follow your questions.
Oh, I'm sure that you will. To start out with, I want to talk about that you were expelled from your birth nation as a child. You were 8 years old?
Seven.
7 years old. And I want to ask you if you'll read a passage from your book that really takes us there to that.
Yeah, I would be happy to. And if you just give me a moment here. In the end, on the afternoon it all ended for our family, we knew by name each neighbor walking right into Ma's tidy kitchen and carrying away her rice steamer and copper bottom pots without a word. Their eyes went matagalap, vacant as death. I knew those skinny boys who left with Pop's RCA and his Radan easy chair on their bony shoulders, iron pipes and hoe handles hanging heavy from their hands. We knew they were Saleh Muslims and we were Kabatinan. They were Manado while we were Indo. No one knew it mattered until the chaos.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What captured me about that passage was what I've heard about what's really called ethnic cleansing. We call it ethnic cleansing in the newspapers. And you took me to the personal face of it. I've heard stories of people from the Balkans when the wars were going on in Bosnia, Serbia, and Kosovo talk about neighbors, people they knew coming in and taking their belongings and shooting their men. And so I wanted to ask you, what was the impact of that really incredibly difficult experience on you as you developed and grew up in this country and your politics developed and you developed into a civil rights attorney and a human rights activist?
A difficult question, and you're right, those are difficult times. And I have to tell you, Linda, we had to move twice. You know, once when we were expelled from our country, and a second time when we were given asylum in the United States. So we moved again from the Netherlands to Salem, Oregon. And the reason I'm saying this is because those two moves were, for me, very, very different. You know, one is a little kid and one is a bigger kid. And maybe with your other guests who you've spoken to, they experience things as adults, maybe as parents. And each of those experiences, I think, delivers a different kind of narrative. So this first one, the one I read, is probably the one in many ways I find most trustworthy, because children experience things so immediately. And there's not a lot of ducking, you know, and there's not a lot of intellectual structuring that makes the experience anything more than what it is immediately in your heart, in your bones. You know, I recall still the smell of fear. And I recall, I didn't write about this, but our auntie passed away on top of my brother and I, and to this day I smell her peeing on us and the hotness of her blood as she was beaten to death. So that's what I walk away when you ask me about war or about murder or ethnocide. That's how I recall it, really, in my bones, you know, in the very fibers.
And I think it's important for us to hear that kind of experience, because for many people, and you do point this out in other parts of your book, for many Americans, we've never, those of us who have not gone to war in another country, have never experienced anything of that magnitude. And it seems like we think of it as only big politicians and big movements of people and big armies, instead of the very personal experience. I was wondering if that experience of people you knew acting against you in any, and I know that there are many other immigrants who've come to this country who have been on different sides of conflicts that were exactly that personal, people from the Balkans. How did that inform your politics as you grew, or do you trace it that way?
Oh, yeah, that's a big question. Can I ramp towards it this way?
Yes.
And it's where you started the question. I think it's important for fellas like me who have a voice now and are listened to express in our way that war is not what happens on CNN. You know, with those little map, the big maps, and you have retired generals pushing tanks and stealth bombers across the map, showing how armies are advancing or how enemy armies are retreating. War is nothing like that. War is nothing like that. War is like this, as I tried to describe, of children just needing to come home from school, or mothers not coming home from market, or fathers picking up children's body parts. That's war. And it's so lucky, in a way, and I'm getting to your question, that America has not had war in your neighborhood, on your street. That you know, you come home, my poppy didn't know whether our house would be home there, our house would be where he left it when he went to work, or that his wife would still be there, or be there but something very bad happened. This is such an important thing not in an American consciousness, and it makes us capable, I think, of sending ferocious armies or stealthy bombers to flatten other people where they live. I think you lose that willingness to do that once you've had war in your house, in your home.
So it's made you a man of peace, or a man who seeks peace?
Maybe I just don't have the power to clobber people, you know, and that's so much the thing with men, right? We abuse power. I've never had any, so I won't. I can't say.
You can't say if you had power, though I have a feeling that you would not want to abuse it.
Well, it's like Barack's wife says to him, you know, watch it, buddy. You know, let's keep this real. You know, we have women, we have intact families, we have people who love us in our, stronger ethnic cultures, who sort of check you and don't let you get entirely crazy about yourself.
Well, some people would say that laws are what keep people from doing this to each other. Laws and those who are willing to enforce the laws, those who create the structures to enforce laws that can be there to protect people. And I know that right now in the international community, there have been many war crimes tribunals going on. There are ones happening still in Rwanda. There are people being tried, convicted in the Balkans. Also in the Sudan, there was recently with a horrible aftermath when the leader in Sudan was indicted for war crimes. So there's also one going on in Cambodia of a Khmer Rouge leader, a leader who has confessed to being responsible for running a camp where at least 12,000 people were tortured and executed. Of course, you're very familiar with the Southeast Asian community as a whole here in Portland. I wanted to ask you what you thought of this latest tribunal going on, and any insights you can give us into the effect it's having on the Cambodian community here.
Yeah, again, it's such a big question, and there are so many answers, all good. about things like this. And, you know, I'm a lawyer. I've actually studied at the Hague Institute in the Netherlands, and I was going to be on a defense team until Mr. Milosevic killed himself in a jail cell. This is in the war tribunal, war crimes tribunal. There's three parties, the victims, the prosecutors, and the defendants. I was going to represent victims. So I really have a personal commitment in education and money towards being a lawyer. But, you know, I don't believe in law that much. I suppose there are good reasons for these events, and there are historical reasons and cultural reasons for having a legal framework within which people behave themselves. I mean, all that's true. Because you can see in times of war, or in times of, in Iraq, when one army leaves and another army is taking a little while to get settled, it becomes lawless. So I think law is important. For me, though, I prefer thinking about and acting on things at a different level. If these tribunals in Phnom Penh are intended to heal people, I think they might have that effect. But I think there's many other ways to get folks who have been traumatized by discontinuities that profound and dislocations that profound. There are other ways that are more direct, that are more human, and a lot less expensive.
I'm speaking with Renault Catalani, also known as Polo. He is a community leader in the Southeast Asian community. Carla Del Ponte, who was the chief prosecutor on the tribunals over the Balkans and also over Rwanda, has said that there's a need for tribunals to end the impunity with which leaders go about these massacring of their neighbors, and that she felt that these kinds of ethnic cleansing and genocide are not just part of human nature, but they're used by men to gain power, to gain probably just goods, money, that kind of thing as well, and corrupt people in power to dominate and control the rest of us, and that they need to have these kind of tribunals to stop their sense of impunity, their sense that they can do this and get away with it. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I'm certain that's correct. I'm certain that's right. In fact, there are many people who probably should also be prosecuted, other than failed states, you know, or the usual weak leaders who don't really have any international support or military support for them anymore. There are a ton of people who should also be persecuted, prosecuted for harming families in these massive efforts, mechanical murder.
Well, that's one of the clearest weaknesses of the tribunal so far is that in this nation, there are leaders who have been accurately described as committing war crimes. They've confessed to ordering torture. We're talking about Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld, et cetera.
Yes.
And they're not yet brought to any tribunals.
Yes.
However, the Spanish prosecutor that brought Pinochet finally to court, or, you know, brought him closer to justice, the former leader of Chile, he is now wanting to file charges against Bush officials. So the question is, can leaders of the most dominant country in the world actually be held to account? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's up for grabs, and maybe not.
Yes, and what you said is important. The prosecution of former Latin American strongmen is really, really necessary. Alberto Fujimori right now has returned to Peru. He's so arrogant, he has returned to Peru and has actually been convicted of a number of corruption and murder, I think, as well, and kidnap. And we'll see what the sentences are. But what I wanted to return to is something I know better, and that is whether it's Khmer Rouge, Cambodia, or the expulsions in my own country, or the ethnocide of Chinese in our country, in Indonesia, before our own expulsion. Of course, there's a very bad man, but, you know, there are armies of folks running around doing mayhem on each other. When I was growing up, River Jambi was like Willamette River here, same breadth and depth, but it was bodies every day for 3 weeks as we rubbed out maybe 500,000 Chinese. We will never know. In this orgy of murder. And it wasn't the police, you know. Of course it was. And it wasn't the army, but it was us. It was regular folks. And I think if you look too deeply, you will find in Cambodian communities in America, in Oregon, in Portland, in Cambodia, in France, in Canada, wherever you find Khmer people, you will find people who have murdered other people. This effort takes one really crazy man to lead, you know, a few colonels and majors and lieutenants as well to manage. But on the whole, it's us. It's just regular folk who do the work that we're told to do.
I'm speaking with Polo Catalani. He's a poet, a commentator for the Wisconsin and the Oregon Public Broadcasting. He's also been a fellow with the Hague Institute for Human Rights and the International Court of Justice. Polo, if what you're saying is so, and it is so, I know that there are, of course, people who've committed severe crimes who are in many nations all over here. In fact, a beauty queen's father was recently challenged and may have to leave this country because he was found to have been part of a Serbian army that committed massacres. No, he's disputing that. But nonetheless, that's another one of those cases here in Portland. So given that, is there a solution? Is there a way for those of us who, you know, are horrified by it, and of course I think almost all humans are on some level, to put an end to this kind of way of governing?
Yeah, I think so. The slate needs to be cleaned, you know, the table needs to be polished again, and then we can get to that kind of governing. But until the bitterness is swept out of the way, I don't think we can. And our elders, you know, like the Lion of Africa, Nelson Mandela, or Desmond Bishop Tutu, have set out a model of how we need to begin forgiving ourselves and forgiving each other before we can begin the business of being a nation, you know, or a country, or a county, or a state, or a village. And I think as much good as tribunals do, what we really need to do is all of us, and I mean young men and women coming back from Iraq, having been asked to do horrible things where people live, are living with this. We are responsible for the dehumanization of those servicemen and women, as well as the dehumanization of the people they victimized overseas. You can't imagine sending an army having boys come back here and everything be fine. I think the Vietnam generation, the Korea generation, by now should have proved that you can't do that. We have deeply, deeply wounded America.
Our ranks of our homeless on our streets are filled with veterans.
Wounded. And I don't know how it happens, and I can't speak for women, right? I know nothing about girls, but with fellas, with men, our father's grief runs right down into our sons. And they act out without having been the recipients, you know, of this violence, this brutality, or the even having themselves been the actors, will act out what their fathers don't. So we know in Cambodian America, or as you've suggested with American veterans from Vietnam, that there's a great deal of rage, a great deal of sorrow, a great deal of grief that needs to be settled before our society can be healthy and happy and move forward. I think America has gone to war almost every decade since who knows how far back. You know, I've counted, 14 wars since we've been in America.
Well, and we've been at war for over the last decade, certainly.
Yes, yes.
More than the last decade, almost the last two decades.
And think of what harm this does to Americans as we become farther and farther dislocated from the rest of humanity, from, you know, our precious Mother Earth, from God. So to get back to your tribunal question, I think it's important, but there are other more important things that are much more of a concern for folks like me who are working fellows, who work with people, solving more everyday problems.
Well, let me take you to another scenario. I'm taking you a different direction now. A couple of your, I call them stories, you call them essays in your lovely book, and I'm speaking with Renault Catalani. In that book, Counterculture, you have some wonderful vignettes. One of them is you find you're out of money and your ATM isn't working and you're standing in line wanting to get coffee. And there you see one guy and you go back and talk to him and he offers you some pastry. And then you see two more guys and they offer to buy you a cup of coffee or an example like that. And you're all of different races, or two of them are one, but you're all basically a mixed ethnic group, and you find a real camaraderie. You find a real taking care of each other, kind of a home in each other's company. I wanted to know, how generalized is that in the immigrant community here in Portland at large, in the larger immigrant community? That kind of cross-cultural connection.
Yeah, in Portland, this is for us normal. In Portland, this is not everywhere so. But two points I want to make. For one, all what we call, you know, old world cultures share so much the same ethos, share so much of the same aesthetic, and they tend to be very people oriented rather than thing oriented, and tend to be sort of right brain, sort of almost female ways of adapting ourselves around each other. So there is, once we break down the nationality problem or the religion problem, we behave in much the same way toward each other, you know, upper or lower, younger or older, male and female. So there's a kind of familial feel between Hmong and Mexicans. There's a familial sensibility between Arabs and Asians. One, it doesn't take but a good leader or a good time together, a dinner, like our colored pencils nights last Fridays at CIO of every month. When that vanishes, the walls of nationality, and we are all having great fun, laughing, crying, eating, singing, doing poetry together to great excess. So yes, I intended to make a point of that, how quickly we respond to each other as men.
It's something that I know African-American friends of mine have said about running into another African-American. Yes. And in many parts of the United States, it wouldn't be as not frequent as here, but we tend to be very white here. And yes, they'll talk about you run into another African-American, even if you don't know them. There's always the nod that says,
yes,
hi, yes, we share something.
Yes, and in the workplace, you know, you can't pass another Latino or another Asian or another African-American without looking at each other, nodding. To us, if you don't look at someone, you hate him, or he's a dog or a bad kid. And this is very difficult, and this is part of the sharing of an ethos we have, I think. It's hard, even though I've been in America for more of my life than anywhere else. It's very hard leaving work and not having my white coworkers look at me and touch me and say, drive home carefully. And we say, salamat jalan, God's blessing on your trip, so you come home safe. You know, I feel hurt that my work is not appreciated. I've worked so hard. I've given the best of myself. So for us, we say this to each other. You know, good night. See you tomorrow. In the morning, the same thing. And so this is sort of what I'm focusing on in this book. There's a new normal evolving, and it's the cultural capital, the social capital that we're bringing to America. Make no doubt about this, we love American financial capital, political capital, technological capital. But we bring this whole other world, and if we are going to be familia, and that's what these relationships are, they're family relationships, we fall back on how we act in a family, we're all going to be fine. That kitchen table, as Barack Obama has proven, has room for people from Kansas and from Kenya. We're all the same people.
I'm interested to explore one bit of that with you. There's one story in your book where you're in Vietnam. You've been up all night trying to negotiate the release of prisoners held. And you're sitting there in a little back, kind of hidden area, having breakfast with people you're familiar with. And in come back three American tourists, I assume, men tourists. And they're described pretty much as big clumsy louts who are pretty loud and don't realize how rude they are. And they're not meaning to be rude, but are rude in their approach and their behaviors. And you're kind of angry at them. What are they doing disturbing your morning? I could hear some Americans going, why does he speak so bitterly of us? If he doesn't like us, why does he come live in this country? I've heard that kind of thing. So I wanted to give you a chance to say something about that.
No, you know, we love Americans. Bill Clinton was in Vietnam at that time when we were doing extractions of priests, politicians, poets, and professors. And folks love Bill Clinton, and women love Hillary Clinton. Crowds of women chanting, Hillary, Hillary, respectfully, whispering it at a distance, followed her around. So that isn't that. It isn't that at all. These men were acting like boys. They were rude, undisciplined. We say, your mother didn't love you right. Right?
I love that phrase.
Your mother didn't love these boys correctly. It's not their fault. They're just little boys in big bodies, and no one told them not to behave this way, to think about other people's feelings. This is not your neighborhood. You can't look at our women this way. We men are going to get very upset. If you look at our women this way and assume you can, and that among brown men, if I'm looking at your woman and you see me, you're going to punch me, and I know it. I know this as an if it's an Arab man, an African American man, a Chinese man, it doesn't matter. We know this, and I'm wondering why is it these fellas don't know? You're stepping into my home. You're looking at my sisters, and you're treating her very badly. What? How on earth did you folks get so powerful and so wealthy? You know, with this kind of approach at living.
Might be because it's a direct aggression has gotten our nation into this place.
It's worked.
Might have something to do with it.
It's worked. But we're turning a corner in America. There's a new normal now in the White House.
Well, Polo, I'm sorry to say we're at the end of our interview. There's so much more that I'd love to talk to you about, and I really thank you for coming and speaking with us at KBOO. I've been speaking with Renault Catalani. He's the author of Counterculture, Immigrant Stories from Portland Cafe Counters. It's published by Colored Pencils Publications, and which is in both Portland and Bangkok, which is a wonderful representation of who Polo is, that it's published in both of those. And it can be picked up at the Asian Reporter, where Polo is a contributing editor.
Powell's.
Thank you so much for coming and joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.